Welcome back to Focus on the Arts. This show delves into the arts, music, painting, drawing, theater, and any other form of artwork. Join us weekly here to hear more about our take on the arts with your hosts, Latham Woodward, John McCormick, and Sarita Patel. Welcome back to Focus on the Arts. Today with John McCormick, Sarita Patel, and me, Latham Woodward. Thanks for being here, and thanks for listening to this podcast. If you like this kind of content, please like and subscribe to Crashing Boar Productions. We greatly appreciate it, and the algorithm sure likes it too. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Sarita, welcome back.
Thanks, Latham. Nice to see you both.
It's nice to see you both. And John, you've had an interesting week with your son seeing your video on YouTube and surprised at how many people are watching, which is now a fairly large number, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's always good.
Yeah.
Feels good. My son, who's an artist in Los Angeles, Los Angeles-based artist, he's 37 years old, and his career has really taken off over the past 10 years. And he, you know, like many people in his generation, is really engaged in with social media and in a way that maybe my generation wasn't, because it wasn't there first and foremost. He does a lot of his business through social media, and so he was happy to see that I'm kind of diving into it. Although I will say I have been engaged for some time, but doing a video with you was really wonderful, and he saw it, and he was very complimentary, and he was especially happy. I kind of alluded to my son, who in the video, when we were talking about younger artists. So he's totally on board.
The old man's got some juice.
Still in the game, you know.
Well, you know, I think it's also interesting because you have a younger son, and with all of the news about the negative effects of social media on people's well-being. And this, to me, is like the perfect bridge between being able to use internet technology in a balanced way because of maybe the background and the part that art plays in your daily life, you know, every minute by minute.
Right. And, you know, like one of the things, you know, we both engage in is Instagram. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been involved with Instagram for I think well over a decade now, and when it first came online, there was a lot of art. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people posting their paintings and sculptures and fine art, and that's kind of gotten, you know, it's still there, but there's a lot more commercial stuff on there now. Like everything that happens once it gets an audience, you know, other people will move in there. And so, you know, there was this time though, and then it had a little more purity, in my opinion, about it. But it's still a wonderful tool for artists to post their work and try to get out to a larger audience. You
know? Yeah, so, it is. Yeah. I mean, it's inspiration. It's, yeah. You know, I brought in a catalog today, Latham, and John was looking at it, and it's artists from the 1700s to 1910. And he was just flipping through it, seeing, you know, the difference in art as it is portrayed or displayed, mm-hmm. and how it affects, you know, our mood, what's going on in the world. And so what you just said about the beginnings of Instagram, there was a purity to it.
Yeah, kind of an innocence almost. And, you know, that's, you know, not unusual, but then people start seeing how they can monetize or commercialize, you know, things take on different. It takes on different meanings. It still retains that kind of platform for artists, fine mm-hmm. artists, but it's become a lot of other things mm-hmm. too.
I like how you brought us in here by saying about impact on people's lives, right?
Yeah.
So we were just talking right before you got here, John, about these shows. You know, you see them all over Europe, the Lumiere shows, whether you have a Van Gogh or Starry Night. We were just discussing, how do you interpret this? I mean, is it good for the art, good for the artist, good for the people who see it? I think they're interesting. These shows, they're always in some grand location, right? Mm-hmm. And they drag you in. I mean, it's meant to, I think, bring in new viewers to the arts, which mm-hmm. is very positive. But Sarita was saying that she has an interpretation of artwork sometimes before you go in, and then you're like, this is not what I imagined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, context says a lot, you know. And so when people see a piece of what we would call fine art in a commercial context, the association might, you know, for that person at that time might be one thing. And then if they see it in a museum, it might take on a different association. So, you know, I talked about my son who's doing his fine art and he's doing well with it, but he's also involved and partnered in a clothing company. And the clothing company is called One of These Days. Little shout out to the clothing company. And it's mostly clothing that's, geared towards 20 and 30 somethings, you know.
Yeah.
And he was the guy that started the company, his partner, my son Matt, was kind of on the periphery of all of that. And this other fellow, his name is Red, said, well, I'd like to use some of your imagery from your paintings on the clothing. Well, that opened up a whole door for Matt to get his artwork out to a much larger audience. You know, obviously it's a more commercial way of getting your work out there. But what he's come to realize over a number of years now is that a lot of people can't afford his paintings, for starters, or his prints or some of his fine art, but they like his art, and this is a way of them kind of finding a way in by buying like a t-shirt, let's mm-hmm. say, that has. And you know, you worked with Andy Warhol, Sarita, mm-hmm. and Andy was he was right on that cutting edge of saying, you know, art can be Campbell's soup cans, you know.
Well, and he had a very famous saying, all art is a lie.
Well,
you know,
right. Well, but it's a kind of a, you know, a tough line to walk. But I have to say, and I'm probably bragging a little bit here, but my son has managed to create this kind of commercial side to his art, which allows people to access his more serious art form. And I think that just comes with the time we live in. And it probably started in earnest in the 60s with people like Andy Warhol and others who said, you know, Peter Max, who put art out there to a much wider audience and took it out of the kind of hallowed halls of just museums and made it available to a lot of people. Having said that, you know, there is a distinction between commercial art and fine art, or applied arts, like you mentioned last week, banknotes and things like that. Those are applied arts. Fine art is in a different place, and we can talk about that.
Do you remember in the 80s, very famous guy who transcended between those two lines, not my flavor, but Leroy Neiman?
Oh, yeah, Leroy Neiman. Yeah.
Great artist, but, you know, he definitely went toward the sports figures and different things. He brought in this, like, new element.
Yeah. Leroy was,
different.
Was different. Was Leroy. Well, he was openly, commercial about what he was doing, but he had all the gifts of a fine artist in terms of his draftsmanship and so forth.
Oh, know? Sure.
Yeah.
But it was very 1980s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. The colors. I mean,
and he was a character, you know, big cigars.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So what did we call that in the 80s? So we all lived in the 80s and we didn't say, this is so 80s, right? I can't remember how we referred to all that fun stuff.
Kitsch. I think that was the overall. You can easily get into a place where it's kitsch art, but you know.
Well, remember, even Keith Haring designed shoe boxes for Ferragamo.
Henry Matisse designed glassware when, you know, when he needed the money. So artists, you know, did what they always had to do to, you know, put food on the table and make ends meet, you know.
Norman Rockwell.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
You know, you had to do what you could say. Sarita knows this one intimately, you know.
You could say Michelangelo, I mean, he really didn't want to paint the Sistine Chapel. It was a commission by the benefactors of that time, which was the church. He would much rather have been doing his sculpture. He thought of himself more as a sculptor than a painter, and yet he did that and was paid handsomely for it. So there you go.
Well, you leveraged us right into our institutional art conversation.
Segue. That was
good segue, man. Yeah, it was about patronage, you know, and whether patronage affects your art. And obviously Sistine Chapel, if it affected his art, it affected it in a great way.
It did. After they said after he did that, his sculptures actually, you know, all the drawings he had to do and all, you know, the musculature of his sculptures looked better. So, you know, everything is cumulative again, you know.
Well, sitting upside down for so long.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That'll do it.
I wonder if there's a correlation also to when you get paid to do something, it all of a sudden becomes drudgery.
I've never thought that.
I mean, I've never thought it either, but, you know.
No, well, it depends on the job, I suppose. You know, if you're used to kind of calling your own shots and you're having to really put your, you know, 9-to-5 kind of hat on, it might be. But my experience has always been I'm more than happy to do commissions for people. I've turned down ones that I didn't think were going to go in the right direction and you know, didn't seem to fit what I felt my work was about. And people would say, well, I'd like you to do this. Well, that's not what I do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So they were trying to shoehorn you into what their vision was?
Yeah, a little bit. They wanted to, you know, they had an idea and a vision about something, and they thought I could provide that, and I said, well, that's not exactly what my work's about, and you know,
yeah.
So I politely declined.
In the famous words of our friend John Crane, the screenwriter, said, "Never let anyone take over the creative process."
Exactly.
Well, you shouldn't.
But you know, that kind of segues into, you know, you know me as somebody who doesn't know a lot about art. I love art. I've seen a lot of art, and I shouldn't even say I don't know a lot about art. I'm just always a curious
student
of this. But what you just said, the way you were talking with your client, potential client, is something I think a lot of clients need to understand, that actual back and forth with the artist is part of the birthing process of a really beautiful project.
Yeah.
When there's the involvement.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, in truth, in my experience, when people come to me and say, you know, I'd like to commission you to do a piece. We have a specific area that in, you know, a specific size in mind or something like that. They're coming to me because they already know what my work's about. Mm-hmm. And so they're not going to say, I want you to, you know, do something completely different. Because, you know, in all likelihood, I'd say, well, that's not me, you know. So, yeah.
You know, that reminds me of a project that I was doing, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago. It was a stained glass project, and the client actually had a very specific idea of what kind of stained glass they wanted in this building, and I brought in somebody called Theodore Ellison, who's out in Oakland, and asked Ted to just hang out on the property, you know, for a couple of days and come up with a scheme of what he thought that the windows should look like. There were, you know, multiple windows to be made. And his idea was completely different than the client's, but the client really saw, you know, just sort of the living art in the stained glass that the artist had created. And it was a really beautiful thing to watch. You know, somebody who had a very specific idea of what he wanted, and this artist's view was completely different, but actually better.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good. Mm-hmm. Things do work out, oddly enough.
Yeah.
I want to talk about also the, you know, the institutionalized art around government-sponsored art. And are you aware of the thing that they do in the Netherlands with art students? Like, basically, it's a form of welfare, kind of, where they pay young artists to produce art.
Mm-hmm.
And you're given a runway. You know, you're several, 5 or 6 years, you get to do this.
Right.
And now they have these huge aircraft hangars full of these arts.
Mm.
And it's an interesting way. This week, I published an old best of episode of my Dazed and Infused podcast with Tommy Chong. And during that episode, Tommy says, I asked him, he said, I have the solution to the immigration idea. And I go, I got to hear this really from Tommy Chong. He says he wants to employ all these, you know, people come across illegally and give them gainful employment as extras in Hollywood. Everywhere.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's a very creative way of dealing with a welfare situation by sponsoring artists to produce art. But then again, you've got warehouses full of it. So what do you do with this? I mean, is that art, or is it just sponsorship and keeping people busy?
Are you asking me that?
Yeah, I am asking you that. What do you think? I mean,
well, I can't speak to what goes on in Denmark because I'm not familiar with it, but I know that.
Or in Holland.
Or Holland.
Yeah.
But in this country, a couple examples would be a program that, you know, President Kennedy started, the National Endowment for the Arts.
Yeah.
And so, you know, artists for decades now have, and art, not just individual artists, but arts organizations, whether it's a dance company or a theater company in the city somewhere.
Or go back to the WPA.
Yeah, well, yeah, there was and the National Endowment, and I'm not sure where it's at right now in the current administration, but for decades it's served communities and artists, you know, in tandem with creating art. And it was a pretty stringent process, though, to get one of those National Endowment, you know, art grants.
Do you know what they were? I'm not really familiar. I know he did it, but I'm not really familiar with what the process was.
Well, you had to apply, of course, and you had to go through, multiple reviews before you would get the money. So it wasn't like they were just handing it out like candy or anything. You had to have a pretty strong track record of, maybe a pretty strong exhibition history with, if you were a painter. A
portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. John Kennedy got the idea after visiting Ireland during the time of his presidency, where they had this whole program set up in Ireland. And of course, America, he came back and said, America, with all our wealth and being America, we should have something similar. And was part of the idealism of that era. And as far as I know, it's still around, but I'm sure it's been, in the current environment, it's probably been cut back. Another example on a state level that I discovered a few years ago that I thought was a great idea was if you go in New York, the state of New York, you go up the Hudson River Valley. I went for a drive up there because I was, you know, one of the first art movements in the United States was the Hudson River School of Painting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was Frederick Church and a whole group of painters. And it was it's a deep part of our artistic history in this country. And so the Hudson River went through a big transition over the last 40 years, where a lot of the manufacturing moved out of these little towns, and there might be a town that had the Nabisco factory and it moved, mm-hmm. it went offshore somewhere, and all of a sudden there wasn't the infrastructure there anymore to support people. So what the state of New York decided to do was turn a lot of these little towns, which were becoming somewhat abandoned, and they gave artists a grant. You had to apply for it. You had to go through a whole review process. But if you got through that, you could get a grant from the state of New York for, and it was very minimal, it was like $25,000 to open up a storefront or something to kind of bring some life back into this whole corridor of the Hudson River Valley that was such an important part of our history, artistically speaking. And as far as I know, it's working, you know, and it's created tourism. It's given artists a chance to thrive and do what they do. And it's been good for the state of New York. So these things can be, you know, one thing on paper and another thing in reality, but you know, sometimes they work really good and maybe sometimes they don't, but you know, we got to keep trying, you know.
Well, so, right, we always have to keep trying, and so much of it depends on who is actually administrating these programs.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you can, there's lots of grants, lots of fellowships, but it always comes down to, is there an agenda? Is it for the revitalization? But, you know, who the administration is. And
well, you know, during the Roosevelt years, they had, you mentioned it, the
WPA.
WPA, and it gave artists who, you know, were out of work like everybody else a chance to be paid by the government to do murals and things. I mean, over here in Coit Tower, we have some beautiful WPA murals. Mm-hmm. Anybody wants to go over
Pacific Stock Exchange in San Francisco, the original Pacific Stock Exchange has amazing murals in there and statues out front as well.
Right.
But there are literally thousands and thousands of beautiful artworks around the country from that time period. And it not only did it adorn libraries and museums and public institutions, it did crazy stuff like it made the Hoover Dam more pretty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and again, there's a great example of applied arts, you know, and make, you know, the Hoover Dam. I mean, you know, shaping our visual aesthetic, you know. I mean, it could have been the Hoover Dam could have been an ugly thing, and it's a beautiful thing to look at.
I like what you just said, shaping our visual aesthetic, because I think those things do matter. I think the Romans and the Greek ascribed to those things. The Italians certainly did. Well, they weren't Italians; they were the Veronese or whatever they were called, the Florentines.
Right.
But you know, those things about living with art around you, they're important. I just went online to find out about the NEA, and it has had the funding cut pretty drastically. But here's the weird thing. They've taken that money and put it toward the HBCUs, the historically black colleges, and Hispanic serving institutions, along with a bunch of stuff. So they just took the money and put it different places.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some pretty significant cuts to things like photography at Woodstock, Center for Photography at Woodstock, Studio 3 in Richmond, and Cornerstone Theater and Berkeley Rep lost their funding.
Right. Yeah.
So those are bad things. I mean, I think art is meant to be for everyone, and if you're not representing that and you're not allotting proper funding to it, it's bad.
Yeah, you know, which kind of brings us to the question, like, what are the arts for, you know? And I think if you're going to ask that question, you have to say, well, what were they for in the past? And you know, you can go all the way back to tribal times and see that the arts were such an integral part of indigenous people's lives. I mean, there were no, when everybody was engaged in the arts in those times, you know, of course, they were a small tribe compared to, you know, the size of a nation, United States or anything, but people in those indigenous peoples, whether it was here in the United States or anywhere in the world, were all engaged in art in some way. They wore their art, they danced their art, they sang their art, and it was always a part of the actual life of the culture. You know, if they would dance art for good crops or something, you know, a better life, and somehow in our time, it's been pigeonholed into like museums. And so public works, which we've just been talking about, like, you know, the WPA and others, bring the arts to people. So we're not, people are always going to be debates about, well, do I really like that piece of art that's that they put up over there and in downtown San Francisco or something. But you're not going to get a total agreement on anything.
Because all art is subjective, right? Mm-hmm. To the viewer.
Exactly. But the idea is to create some kind of aesthetic life in the populace of the people that they can look at and ponder and maybe have a just 2 minutes of reverie in their day away from the kind of chaos of living in the modern world is probably a good thing in my book. So
I think having art around you enhances what you're doing. It enhances where you're looking at it. Even if it's something behind the art, it may make it prettier mm-hmm. to you. It may make it more joyful. It may make it more pleasurable to go about your day. And sometimes you don't even recognize that there's art there because it just becomes part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. And if that landscape is appealing, then it's successful. You don't necessarily have to recognize that piece of art, but if you recognize it as a broader scheme, as a picture.
Well, and I think that goes to what John was saying about the indigenous, how has it changed over time? And so the older times, which were still times, mm-hmm. they wore, danced, sang. So it wasn't really towards a capitalistic or an agenda. It was just a part of daily life. And I think just like many things that we're talking about, our modern life is very chaotic. It is very capitalistic. We've gone awry, so we can see how art is used that way and mm-hmm. less organic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like I said, it's been kind of marginalized, certainly in our education system, mm-hmm. To me, the irony of that is that there's been multiple studies done on how art, Stanford did a study, and it's like over 30 years ago now, that showed that in high schools where they had art programs 2 or 3 times a week for the students, that those students did much better on all of their other subjects. So the conclusion, became that, we have the right brain, left brain idea, that the right brain is more the intuitive, creative side. The left brain is more the analytical side. So our educational system is geared more towards the left brain, which is mathematics, science, and creating, good consumers, and the right brain being, more the artistic side, is not part of our education system in the same way. But these studies that I alluded to have shown that when you give students a chance to rest that left brain and get involved with some creative, intuitive, project of some art project, painting, music, that it, in a way, it kind of massages the left brain and it creates a whole person in the end. We should really be aiming for that. And I think we have made some strides in that in our education system, but it's still one of the first things to get cut, when we're talking about budget cuts and the music program goes out the door mm-hmm. or the painting program or the dance or theater or whatever.
So. I'd like to mention something that's near and dear to my heart because I'm a photographer, is I love like Dorothea Lange, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Here's a crossover between art, true art. She's a fantastic photographer, but bringing the message of the Dust Bowl to the rest of the United States. And how it became, she was a reporter, an artist, a documentarian, all in one. Like, what do they call it? The one where she, the immigrant, not immigrant mother, but the one where...
Migrant
mom.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just how desperate the situation was back then and how she brought it to light. Then you have the discovered photographs of someone like Vivian Mayer, who was the nanny in New York City, or who carried around the Rolleiflex camera and took thousands of pictures of daily life in New York in the 1940s and 50s. In 1954 was her big year. And then she would discover it after her death about these street photos that represented America at a time and a place and how it captured it. And how important that is in the context of being an American
Yeah.
And how we live as a society, and how you can look back on these random but well staged photos, not staged is the wrong word, but well captured, and just how it represents so much, and it transcends just the simple photograph. It becomes this important link to our past.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes part of our personal history, and we can constantly learn from that. You know, what's that saying? You can't really know where you're going unless you know where you've been. You know,
right.
And people don't. I look at photo. You know, talking about photography, you look at photography from the early 20th century, which is a little over 100 years ago, of children working in these factories. They're like 10 years old. They look like they look very unhappy, but they look like little adults, you know. And
they do.
We've come hopefully a long way from that, you know. But it's something we shouldn't forget. Or the civil rights movement, you know. People don't understand. You know, they talk about. Well, I'm probably getting off on a tangent here, but I still believe we are in a state of reconstruction from mm-hmm. the Civil War, and it's an ongoing process. So the idea of, the Smithsonian, let's say, not being able to put emphasis on Black history at this moment is, to me, a step back in terms of our reconstruction process. But I suppose that's a whole
I think well, no. I think yeah. What you're saying is very valid, and yeah. I think that the time frame is very valid too. We view ourselves as this old society. We're only 250 years old, right?
Right.
Okay. Literally, next year.
Right.
But you look at the French, for instance, who have been a nation for a long time, and they're in their fifth revolution, right?
Right.
So we got a few to go. Here's another photographer that I wanted to mention too, because about capturing something that changed the way people think about it. It's Frank Capra.
Oh yeah.
And how he showed the brutality of war in a way no one else had.
Right. And now, was he on his own, or was he now talking about benefactors and so forth? Was he hired by the government to do those films during World War II? Or?
No. Well, that was Capra.
Oh.
This is Frank Capra, who caught that iconic image of the Spanish Civil War guy being shot dead. He caught it in, like, in
at
action.
The moment. Yeah.
And how he, along with Hemingway, you know, at the time, as another artist, a literary artist, mm-hmm. brought together a view that had not been seen, and how, like, you know, in Hemingway, the Lincoln Regiment, when they go over to help, you know, the Spanish separatists and everything, and how this was horrible, 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 bloody conflict, and no one really knew. It was romanticized
mm-hmm.
until people got there, and it was like, this is hell.
Yeah.
And so with Capra and Hemingway bringing in true versions of these things and letting people know about them, it exposed it, and that art became important to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think art as social commentary has been with us a long time, and certainly in the age of photography, it's much more immediate, and it serves a really important purpose, you know. So
I think it does.
Yeah,
I really do.
Yeah.
Obviously, because I filmed you.
Well, yeah, you did. Well, you know, it just made me think about the migrant mother. You know, that portrait of a white woman with her white kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know. The poverty has no discriminating factors.
No.
And interesting, as we're in these times where everything is pointing to, you know, what is the identifier and why do you feel victimized? Mm-hmm. And yet those photos from way back when show America still dealing with the utter poverty and wealth.
Right. Yeah. No, these are ongoing problems, and certainly they should be documented, and people that we have, you know, still in this time and age, great journalists and artists who are speaking to all of that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another part of how art can impact our lives and bring an awareness to, you know, social issues that are worth taking a good kind of look mm-hmm. at, you know.
Yeah.
So
and I, you know, it's. When you were talking about representation of people and places, Van Gogh, he had representation of people working in the fields. He had normal people in some of his works.
Right.
I mean, those are important little things that show that daily life wasn't just about kings and, you know, fancy people in palaces and stuff. There was normal people.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's important, and it brings us all together. It ties us to what really binds us as humanity.
Right.
We need to know who we are.
Absolutely. And getting back to who we are, I have said this and I'll say it again, that I think in today, the challenges of living in our culture in this time, as we've talked about here, with there's so many demands on us financially, and that I think art engagement at some level can help you sort things out a little better. I really believe that, and I've seen it work in my own life for sure, and I've seen it work in the lives of students that I've worked with and friends who are artists. But again, that can be as simple as, you know, like, okay, you come home, you've had a terrible day or a trying day, let's say. Sit down and listen to some nice music, but don't just put it in the background. Actually sit and listen to it for 15 minutes.
It's so funny. You just said that. I did that yesterday with some classical. I'm not a big classical music fan, basically because I had to play it in band a lot in high school and college. Yeah. But I sat there and listened to some Mozart yesterday, just staring at my speakers, kind of just like soaking it in.
Well, you know, we all are trying to find some level of peace our center. And, when I was teaching adult education, I'd always start off my classes by saying, this is what you can expect, and da-da-da-da. And then I'd say, I know you've paid this much for this class, but it's still cheaper than therapy. Mm. And it'll do a lot more. And lo and behold, most of the time, I dare say close to 100% of the students walked out of there feeling a lot better about what they were doing with their craft or with their efforts. And it helped in other parts of their life, you know. It centered them, you know.
Not to mention the distractive forces of sitting down and drawing or painting or playing music, you know. That's great for your mental health.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, and that's what John said before, right? It re-centers your right and left brain. It is an actual reset.
It is. I mean, again, what we talked about last time was the neuroscience has, over the past 40 years, has focused on how the arts actually change the chemistry makeup of your brain in time, real time. And actually, they found that if you engage in, let's say, meditation, the cellular development of your brain actually is enhanced. And the same is true of engaging in the arts in a creative process where you get into that kind of creative zone, and that you see increased serotonin levels, oxytocin, dopamine levels, all the things that make you feel good and centered are enhanced by engaging in the arts. And that can be as simple as going to a museum and looking at paintings. You don't have to be, you know, Picasso here. You can go to a museum and just ponder some art on the walls for an hour, and it literally shifts, you know, your neuroscience. So.
And I'd like to give a pro tip here for all people who don't go to museums often. If you want to do this and you want to get to a museum and you want to have a wonderful experience, go during the week.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And go in the morning when they open,
because
you'll have the place to yourself.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. I mean, going to the De Young just on those off days, like a Tuesday morning, and you're walking around by yourself and you get to be one-on-one. Or once I went to the Musée d'Orsay and I was standing in front of Van Gogh Portrait in Blue. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, you know, you're a foot away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I just stood there for a half an hour staring at this guy's hand and his work and just marveling in the beauty that I'm standing in front of. It was very emotional. I mean, I got to say, I was very taken in that moment where I'm just sitting there going, I can't believe I'm this close to something so great.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, and that speaks to the power of art. We talked a few minutes ago about, you know, indigenous cultures, and how they understood the, in a spiritual way, the importance of visual art, that they, you know, or dancing, and they, you know, they believed that, you know, certain kinds of art performances would enhance their spiritual life. Now, you know, that may not be a held view by people in our times, but certainly if you get into in front of a painting and sit there for a half an hour and you're entranced by it, you'd have to say that that's some kind of uplifting experience, you know?
I was enraptured.
There you go.
I mean, I was just sitting there just thinking, imagining in my head him doing it, right?
Right.
And perfecting it. Yeah. And how, you know, he was almost, I wouldn't call it gicle, but he was like the oil on his canvases are heavy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no canvas poking through.
Right.
And it's, so it's like, it's almost sculpture.
Really? Well, he used thick impasto paint.
Thick. You know? Is that what it's called? Impasto?
Impasto, yeah.
It was very impressive. Yeah. Yeah, I was very intrigued. That's also where I saw the Van Gogh with, you know, the workers in the field, I think is mm-hmm. what it's called.
Yeah.
Or bringing in the hay, one of those.
Yeah.
And it was just very interesting to be there and be present.
Yeah.
But then again, I have to say, I went to the, what's the big one with the tubes in France out front? The
Pompidou.
The Pompidou.
Yeah.
And going to see the modern art, that was equally impressive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where they have installations in one big room. You're in this giant house has been installed in a room, and it's, you can look into it and around it, and it's got everything going on, and it's too much. It's literally too much. You cannot absorb it in an hour.
Yeah.
You need to come back and come back. And I did.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's closed right now for 5 years, so don't go to the Pompidou.
For 5 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they're doing a big remodel.
Well, that's just it. You can't go for an hour or two. I mean, you can, but it's almost like when I hear people talk about going to any museum, especially when they're going to Europe and they're saying, well, we're going to schedule these two museums on this day and these three on this day. And I'm like, oh my God, are you going to the movies?
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's a good point, because people go to museums and they feel compelled to, like, let's look at every painting. Let's face it, we all have saturation levels. Mm-hmm. We can only take in so much. And so when you go to any museum, gravitate towards the pieces that you feel some mm-hmm. kind of visceral response to. You're not going to like everything, and you shouldn't. You know, we all are different. So there ought to be a handbook. Maybe I'll write that on how to go to a museum, because people feel like I've got to study every piece. And mm-hmm. Oftentimes we mention, like, going to a museum show when there's nobody there. When you go to a museum show where there are a lot of people there, like I just went over to the Legion here. They had this wonderful Wayne Thiebaud show that it's down now. But you walk, you know, you pay your ticket, you go in, and everybody's like almost like an assembly line walking from one painting to the next. And, you know, if it's crowded, go to the painting that nobody's standing around and enjoy that one.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back, and you don't have to see them in one after another, although there is a reason they put these shows together to show maybe the growth of the artist or whatever, in some kind of chronic, chronological growth process. But if it's crowded there, go stand in front of one that there's nobody looking at that moment. I went to see, quick story, the Mona Lisa. And there's like four people deep. You couldn't even get near it. And right next to it was another Leonardo da Vinci painting. And nobody was looking at that. So I spent, you know, time with that until the line had died down over here. And just a little tip that'll make your going to museum experience a little more.
Yeah, John, I think that's really important. I mean, I wished somebody had told me that when I was younger.
Right.
But when I, you know, took my son to museums, I said, just look at the little map, figure out where you want to go
yeah.
ahead of time, And then just go there. You don't have to follow me. You don't have to do what everyone else is doing.
Good.
Really just go see what draws you in.
Right.
Here's another hot tip. If you do like an artist and you're in that city of the artist residence, like the, you can go to the Picasso Museum in Paris, mm-hmm. which I've been to. It's neat.
It's in Antibes.
Antibes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, well, there's the one, the gallery.
There's the little one on the right bank. And
exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then there's the, well, I stand corrected, though. I got to go Antibes now.
That's where he had his studio down there after World War II. And he was painting, and it's an old castle.
Cap Antibes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, or the Auguste Rodin Museum.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, if you're familiar with the sculptor, the Kiss. Go see it in person. Also, but if you do live in the Bay Area, here's a very unrealized fact by a lot of people. Auguste Rodin had a very strong following here in the Bay Area, and many of his best works are actually at the Legion of Honor.
Oh, yeah. They have a whole room of
stuff. Oh, some of his best works are there.
Oh.
And again, Alma Spreckles, who was the Big Sugar heiress, she was a Dali person and a Rodin person, and she bought a lot of Rodins.
Okay.
Which now are the property of the county of San Francisco.
Well, there's a tip for
all
the people listening.
Hot tip.
Get over to the Legion.
Well, you know, I think we've kind of talked our ears off today, and hopefully you guys are still in entertained on the other side of the microphone here. Next week, I'd like to talk about something near and dear to John's heart, and that's music and the arts. And I would really like to talk about not only American jazz, I'd like to talk about classical music, and I'd like to talk about contemporary music.
Okay.
It's a lot to talk about, but it's something.
Okay.
So, Sarita, any parting words today?
No, this was great. I did want to say that the last time we visited, I did make a conscious effort of just listening to music and doing little pieces of art at home.
Good.
And it really did kind of shift me for the next couple of days. And I do practice, but, you know, some days, weeks are just out of control.
That's the week you need to practice more.
That's right.
Agreed.
So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And my parting comment is, no matter what your political stripe is, we need arts in our world.
Yeah. Vote, absolutely.
Vote for art in schools, vote for art in public, and vote for, you know, art as a public installation. Don't let it die. Support the arts.
Hear. I'm all behind that.
Amen, brother.
Amen.
All
right.
Until next time, this has been Focus on the Arts with John McCormick and Sarita Patel, and I'm Latham Woodward, your host. Please like and subscribe. If you like this kind of content, we really appreciate it, and we'd like to bring you more content weekly. Until next time, thanks very much. Thank you for joining us on Focus on the Arts. Join us every week for new guests, entertaining subject matter, and new focus on different art forms. This show has been a production of Crashing Boar Productions, broadcast from the studios of Madbona Studios in San Anselmo, California. Copyright 2025, all rights reserved. If you enjoy this type of content, please like and subscribe. We greatly appreciate it.